Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Yada Ya Radio. It's my pleasure to speak with you on this Shabbat, one in near proximity to the most fun days on the calendar, the celebration of Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim. Larry, I'm assuming that's you in the 904 area code?
No, I'm just pretending to be him.
Okay, all right. Well, your voice sounds a little bit like Larry. I do want to have a brief confession here this evening before we get going. I did not sleep well last night, or I'm not even sure I slept at all last night. Don't know why, but this morning as I was trying to prepare for the Shattering Myths show, I lost power and internet connectivity and kind of a panic to try to say, okay, now what in the world am I going to do? And finally make contact with them by phone. At 2 minutes after the show was supposed to begin. So been a draining sort of a day. So if I'm a car running normally on 6 cylinders and with some regular fuel today, it's like there's 2 of those cylinders that are operating on diesel. So I want to apologize in advance if I don't enunciate clearly and if I don't provide as many useful insights into this testimony as I would normally like to provide. But fortunately, none of us are listening to this program because of my insights, but instead because of what Yahweh had to say. What I do want to do to begin is to cover the territory we had covered last week, and then move on through the rest of Yahshua 17 and 18, and then hopefully after that we'll return to Psalm 119. If you recall, this is what God had to say through his prophet about the days that we are living in today. A prophetic pronouncement regarding Damascus. Behold, Damascus is revolting and corrupt, and will be removed from among inhabited cities. It is degenerate and unrestrained and shall be abolished. And she, Damascus, shall actually become a twisted and tangled heap of rubble. Abandoned and forsaken, estranged, deserted and destroyed will be the inhabited regions and the populated cities of Aurora, speaking of the outcasts in Jordan and Lebanon. For there will be roaming animals fighting in militant militias, failing miserably. But then there will be no one left to terrorize. So the fortified place and the defensive structures will cease to exist on account of the northern kingdom, along with the government out of Damascus, including the remnant of Syria and Assyria, for being similarly vehement, burdensome, fanatical, onerous, dim-witted, and enraged. So what we can glean from this so far is that God said that the last days and these final battles, the major events that precede his return, are going to commence in Damascus. That Damascus, which is fighting for its very survival at the moment, is going to be destroyed. And that it doesn't take a particularly smart individual to recognize that Damascus is revolting, that it is corrupt. Well, according to God, the portions of it right now that have been rendered a heap of rubble, they will be expanded, and the whole city will be that way. It's amazing, of course, that God would begin his testimony speaking of Damascus. Who would have thought that the world's longest continuously inhabited city would be the place where we would see the world heads to war, but it is exactly this place. We are told here.
I really can see why it might be. Maybe a whole hell of a lot of poison came out of there over the years, and it's just desserts, if you will. So.
Yeah, and of course, God is not saying that he's attacking Damascus. He's not saying that he's destroying Damascus. As a matter of fact, he's saying that he's not. It's the corrupt and miserable religious fanatics that are destroying, the militant militias that are destroying the place. And so God is simply telling us what we're witnessing, that it's going to continue, that it's going to get worse, not better, and that he's also telling us, not necessarily that the Sunnis prevail, although that's certainly the implication, over the Shiites, because the government out of Damascus falls.
That's a win for whoever, but they probably Sunnis. Both lose.
Yeah, but I think what God is saying is, that's the point I was going to make, is that I don't like to say that this is affirming that Sunni Islam is going to defeat Shia Islam, which is highly likely, even though right now Damascus is prevailing over the Sunnis for two reasons. One is they're moronic and the way that they're waging this war, and number two, that they're killing each other. The largest two Sunni militias are right now at each other's throat. But if you look at the overall picture, even though right now the war is being won by Assad and the Syrian government, the Sunnis outnumber the Shia 4 to 1. The Sunnis outgunned the Shia in terms of military budgets 10 to 1. And the United States outguns the Russia and China, which are supporting the Assad regime, by 3 to 1. So you put all that together, eventually the Sunnis are going to prevail. But as Larry said, they're both really going to lose. But the government of Bashar al-Assad is going to fall.
Yeah, they're going to fight over a city that isn't even going to exist, so that's a loss no matter what.
Yep. So then this statement is that the children of Israel, those individuals who engage and endure with God, shall actually continue to exist, prophetically declares Yahweh of the vast array of spiritual messengers and envoys. Now, he's going to say a lot of horrible things that are going to reveal a whole lot of just devastating things that are going to happen to Israel. So don't assume that his statement that Israel is going to continue to exist means that Israel is going to be unscathed. That's just not the case. It's just that Israel is going to endure on an ongoing basis, and it's going to survive the Syrian war. Is important because the purpose of the Syrian war from the Sunni perspective is to establish a caliphate, which will then become their foundation to destroy Israel first and then the rest of the world, to conquer them in succession. And God's saying, not going to happen that way. So he gets it right out that what I'm going to be talking about as it relates to Israel is really bad, but Israel is going to survive.
I've got a question for you here.
Mm-hmm.
This is just, your personal opinion. We, at this point, would you support, say, the IDF?
The IDF? Oh, if I were in Israel, would I support the IDF? Yes.
It's Yahweh.
I want to give that a qualification. The qualification is that if I were in Israel, the number one thing I would be doing is doing everything I could possibly do to have Israelites come to realize that the IDF is going to fail, that it's not going to be able to stop what we're going to read about next. And I would be shouting what we're going to be reading from the rooftops, from the roof of every building, and trying to get as many Israelites as possible to rely on Yahweh for their defense as opposed to the IDF. But, that said, you just asked me a very simple question. Would I support the IDF? And Israel is probably the only nation on earth where I would be inclined to support a defensive military. And, the IDF is only used defensively. And so I would support a defensive military structure on behalf of Israel, knowing that there is a time in the not-too-distant future when they are going to be so overwhelmed as to be completely unable to stop the tidal wave of Muslims that are going to invade. What's your opinion on that, Larry? Is it You think it's
I pretty much fall in line with that. I mean, look, you can't. There is no place that I'm aware of in the Torah that Yahweh tells Israel to lay down against invaders. I mean,
no.
Flat out.
No.
And in fact, I would expect he would expect a fight. And,
yeah, he is pretty clear, Larry, about telling them don't form alliances with the Gentile nations. Don't form alliances with Egypt.
This is a big mistake with Assyria. And I agree with that. The stupidity of that is just beyond me. How do you form an alliance with an American government that doesn't even recognize Jerusalem as the capital? I mean, please help me here.
Right.
And has every intention of thinning your nation at the waist.
Yes. So you are correct that in fact, in this particular prophecy, Yahweh is telling Yisrael, do not form an alliance with the United States. Don't rely on the U.S. And so I would say that it is appropriate for Israel to defend itself from the assault of Muslims so long as Israel does not form alliances with Gentile nations and so long as Israel puts its trust and reliance in Yahweh.
Well, that's already
finished. I mean, that's not happening that way,
right?
Really?
Well, it will. It isn't now. It isn't now.
That's right.
And there's only been very brief periods where Yisrael put its trust and reliance on Yahweh. In fact, as we read through this, Yahweh's going to speak of Jacob representing at various times a whole reunited Israel, which means the Northern Kingdom and Yehuda back together. At times it'll be the children of the covenant, the descendants of Jacob, and sometimes it'll be the racial descendants, if you will, the offspring of Jacob, which is all 12 tribes of the children of Israel. So it can be any one of those things, but for most of Israel's existence as the Northern Kingdom, they completely disregarded God, became overtly religious, and formed all sorts of political alliances that ultimately got them destroyed.
To this day, many of my Jewish friends, I mean, and many Jewish people I know, they'll equate Judaism with Israel, which is really sad. I mean, that's sad.
Yeah. Now, I'm completely comfortable associating Yahweh with Israel. I am not comfortable ever associating with Judaism with Israel. In fact, God would disassociate them. All right, so let's move on. And it will come to pass in that day. So what does that tell you? So that means that what is coming next is going to be essentially is going to occur at essentially the same time or as a direct result of the destruction of Damascus and the fall of the Syrian government. And it will come to pass in that day that the size of Jacob will be decreased to a point that it is no longer sustainable. With the fattest, best protected, and most vital midsection of his body leaned, shrinking in size. Now, I've had a map of Israel up for most of these last few days because the little time I've got now to edit and write, I've been working on this chapter. It's now 77 pages long, so it's taken a nice it's gained a lot of information in it. All of the things that Yahweh has to tell us have been updated and amplified and translated. What I haven't done is I've gone through and I've made my commentary on most of it. I'm just going through and now cleaning up my commentary now that I know how this turns out, because sometimes you end up saying things that don't turn out to be true, and you, as you learn, you go through, you have to go back and edit what you've said. So that's what I'm doing at this point, but it is quite clear at this point that God is saying that the thinning of Israel is going to be an event that grows out of the destruction of Damascus and the fall of the Syrian government. So I'm going to speculate here, but I think it's the most logical conclusion based upon the facts, that the tens of thousands of Islamic jihadists from all over the world who have come to fight this great jihad on behalf of Sunni Islam and in the establishment of the caliphate, that when Damascus is destroyed and the Assad regime is brought down, they are not going to cease being Islamic terrorists. And many of them are going to go back to their home, and many of them are going to turn their attention, that home is America and Great Britain and France and throughout Europe. It's Indonesia and Malaysia, and it's throughout the Islamic world and Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait and Egypt and Libya and the Sudan and Somalia. It's throughout the Islamic world, all of those lovely places, in addition to where Muslims are in the West, in the United States and Canada, for example. And exactly what happened after the great jihad that was the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, American-backed great jihad against the Soviet-backed government in Afghanistan. If you recall, when that ended in the late 1980s, after killing about 2 million Afghanis in the process, the jihadists all went back to their countries, and they didn't cease being Islamic terrorists. They continued to be Islamic terrorists, and great acts of terrorism were perpetrated in the world, in Africa, and all throughout Europe, and in the United States. That's what's going to happen after this conflict, except this is the great jihad on steroids. This is the performance-enhancing drug version of what we witnessed in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is not even 1/100th as vital to Islamic interests or to world's positioning of Islam as is Syria. So there's vastly more Islamic jihadists, vastly better armed, vastly more enraged, and so when they go home after this, they're going to perpetrate acts of terrorism that will be equal to or greater than what Europe and the United States and Africa witnessed after the Afghanistan war in that decade that followed. So what do you think the world's going to do? Here's a bunch of Muslims acting crazy, destroying and killing the people the world over, all saying that they're doing so to attack Israel's supporters. So what's the world going to do? How's the world going to respond to that?
The world will turn on Israel.
Right. They will say, well, then the way to appease Islamic rage and to keep Muslims from killing us is for us to abandon Israel and to give the Muslims what they claim they want in Israel, which is a return to the UN 242 and to the conditions experienced, the lines drawn prior to the Six Days War. Now,
yeah, that's what the world will do. Yeah, no doubt about that. I mean, I think it's 2/3 of the United Nations edicts are aimed at Israel, a little
right.
tiny speck of land. I mean, 2/3.
Right.
I mean, this
right.
is outrageous on its face.
And first one was had a modicum of support on behalf of Israel. Of course, it was denounced by the Islamic world. Everyone thereafter has been opposed to Israel. Now, when Israel is thinned this at its midsection. That's why I had the map of Israel up. I really wanted to see, you know, what does that mean? What happens when Hebron? What happens when Bethlehem? What happens when Ramallah? What happens when Jericho? What happens when what's called the West Bank is given back to Muslims and Israel is forced back to the UN 242 prior lines prior to the Six-Day War? You know, the most populated Israeli city by far is Tel Aviv. Nothing anywhere close to Tel Aviv. And And it's the area around Tel Aviv that that 70% of the population of Israelites live. Do you know how wide Israel would be in the 20-mile swath that centers on Tel Aviv, running north and south of Tel Aviv? Do you know how wide Israel will be at that point?
No.
At our midsection?
How wide?
5 miles.
I was going to say seven.
5 miles.
Yeah, 7, 10, 5, either way, that's
so
nothing.
With 5 miles separating Muslims who will be armed to the teeth, enraged, separating them, and the other side of Tel Aviv is the Mediterranean Sea. How long do you think the Jews are going to survive? Yeah.
I mean, they're going forever, if you ask me.
And why, since you've got all those Muslims on that side, and you've got on the other side the sea, it's easy to see why God's going to transition and condemn America for its sea prowess, its navy, because that's the only retreat the Jews have. And God's going to condemn America before we're finished with this prophecy. So that does not bode well for us. All right, so, and then it shall be like a gleaning in, a receiving of a harvest, of reaping the grain and from the chaff in the season, cutting it away so as to remove it from a vexing time of grief, thereby establishing and validating the standing grain. So we go immediately from Israel, not mean sustainable, because it's thinned at the waist to what's going to be 5 miles wide. And by the way, just below Tel Aviv, of course, is Gaza, and they're going to create a thoroughfare, a free passageway from Gaza to the West Bank for these Muslims. So it's literally going to dissect Israel in two. But God transitions from, you know, Damascus is a heap of ruins. You got marauding Islamic terrorism taking place in Syria. The government in Syria falls in that same day. You've got Israel thinned at the waist, and the next thing he has to say is the harvest. So what it tells you here is that the teruah harvest is going to immediately follow the thinning of Israel at the waist. That's the succession of things. It's going to... The Syrian civil war is going to continue. Israel's going to be thinned at the waist. The teruah harvest is going to occur. Now, the teruah harvest is going to occur, this says, to keep the children of the covenant out of the time of vexing grief, to remove the standing grain from the time of vexing grief. The time of vexing grief is obviously the tribulation.
And Yao Kanan says the same thing.
Right. Yeah, and it's actually in Yosha's revelation to Yao Kanan, where he's speaking of the Philadelphian ecclesia, and he's saying of the Philadelphian ecclesia that those who love my name and love my word, they will be kept out of the time of tribulation. This says exactly the same thing. This harvest of standing grain, which is symbolic of the barley that is standing at the time of Passover, matzah, and bukurim, that they're going to be removed from the time of vexing grief. And it's going to validate us, this harvest, which is received in season, which means it'll occur on teruah, that'll be the harvest in season, it's going to occur just as the tribulation is about ready to begin. While there could be months and years in between these various things, the way this reads suggests to me that it is that the Syrian civil war is going to continue for a while, that it could last well into 2022, 23, 24 before Damascus
until Damascus is a heap of ruin, it's going to go on.
That is correct.
And if you look at it, it's, I don't know, 20% of the city now. is looks like a twisted heap of ruin.
Right.
That means they got, you know, 80%
to go. And it also means that this harvest is not going to incur until Israel is thinned at the waist. It has not yet been thinned at the waist. Gaza's gone, but Gaza was the small part of this. It's the West Bank and how the West Bank comes within 5 miles of the Mediterranean Ocean, where right near Tel Aviv. That's the big part of this. So that has not occurred. So since that has not occurred, this fall is not going to be the Teruah harvest. It's not going to occur until after Israel is thinned at the waist. And immediately thereafter, it's going to occur. And following that is a time of vexing grief. Now, it doesn't mean that we're right in the moment of the tribulation, but I suspect we are. Because there's a lot of vexing grief that's going to occur before the tribulation actually begins. We're witnessing it. But I think
I'm watching people now full of fear, wondering how they're going to get by from week to week, just here in this country, as they systematically take to pieces a fabricated economy. It's just unbelievable.
Yep. But, so this is the timing of things. We can we know that we have time so long as the West Bank hasn't been given to the Muslims. We know we have time so that so long as Assad's stays in power. We know we have time so long as Damascus stands. When those things have taken place in this order, then we know that the next Teruah could be the one. But we do know that there will be a harvest before the tribulation becomes intense.
Yeah, and there's good reason for that. And yeah, I just want to point this out again to everybody. I'm sure everybody in the chat room knows this and those listening, but, you know, it's not in Yahweh's nature to watch his children suffer needlessly. And if they get it, they get it. If they don't, they don't. You know, people. You know, you get a lot of the religious types that say, just when God needs me the most, you think he's going to take me?
That's well, I can guarantee
doesn't
you.
Doesn't really have a need for you, pal.
Yeah, I got news for you. You know, I devote most of my day to studying and sharing what I'm learning. I can tell you for certain God doesn't need me.
Right.
He doesn't need me, and it's for darn sure he doesn't need a religious person. So,
but there's people, though, that think they're a great sacrifice, and they're ready to go out there and bear that cross. You know that, and it's just outrageous.
Well, and it's, of course, those people who know that they are totally incompetent and that by being allowed to, having this wonderful opportunity to convey Yah's message at this time is a thrill, and that their qualifications are only that they're incompetent, that they're
that's a way to put
a dented and dirty unrefined implement, and that the recognition that you're that is the only thing that qualifies you for the job. You don't tend to get a big ego on this, you know. It's not conducive to.
I don't expect people to have it, you know, that have it back asswards to you know, get it right. I really don't.
Yeah.
So
now I have long come to the conclusion that, you know, some of the insights that we share we've known for a long time, and others we've known for a very short period of time, and many we've had to retool based upon what we've learned along the way. One of the things that has been a long-term understanding is what Zeruah means. And with the Zeruah, his sacrificial lamb, his strong arm and ability to shoulder burdens, and his visible appearance as light, he will be collecting and harvesting the first fruits. So there's two affirmations here that I think are important, but that we've known for a long time. That first fruits represents not a harvest of crops, but instead of saved souls, and that Bokorim and Shavuah and Teruah and Kippurim are all harvests. So we have a harvest of saved souls when we're adopted into Yahweh's family. We have a harvest in the middle of the year when we are enriched and empowered by Yahweh, and we have a harvest in the fall whereby God's children are called home on Teruah, and ultimately when Yahweh returns, his return, while it is a harvest in the sense of he's gathering in his children into his storehouse, which is Yisrael, it's not a harvest in the sense of leaving the planet, because they're going to be here for 1,000 years. So this affirms that since God is going to conduct this harvest using his Zeruah, that we are right in identifying the Zeruah as the sacrificial lamb, his strong arm. Realization, by the way, is, again, we don't, can't take much credit for this, because all you have to do to properly translate any one of the interesting terms that are found in the Torah and prophets is just look at the first time they're used, and what you find is the Zeruah describes the sacrificial lamb associated with Passover. So he is the one that's going to perform this. I don't think at this time he's going to be visible to the world. I think he will be only visible to those of us who are brought home. Then he goes on to talk about this. He says, and it will be as a gleaning, a smaller secondary harvest of ears of grain in the valley of Raphaim, in the midst of souls destined to die. This is a...
That's accurate.
Yes. Now, Lakot is what I've chosen to name this particular chapter, because a Lakot is a gleaning. It's a smaller secondary harvest. So if you gleaning is not a word that we use in our normal vocabulary, but when you understand that gleaning means a secondary and smaller harvest, then you have an understanding of where this fits in the overall sequence of things, that the first and primary harvest was Bukkudim, and then this is a secondary harvest. But it's still a harvest, and God is harvesting us from the Valley of Death. Raphaim is the Valley of Death. It's the Valley of Raphaim, which is in the midst of souls destined to die. So the earth that we will be leaving is going to be a place of great fatality. The vast preponderance of those who are left behind are going to die. And so Yahweh is removing his children before this terrible onslaught of human slaughter. And so
the asteroids hitting the planet, everything else. I mean, there's no way around this.
And I think the asteroid hitting the planet, well, that's going to be devastating. And the side of the mountain off the coast of Spain falling into the sea from the island is going to be devastating. I think the primary devastation is war. I think that is the primary source of devastation is war. Well, that and Yahweh stopping warriors from destroying the promised land. But collectively, a lot of things are going to go bad. There's going to be pandemics. There's going to be famines. There's going to be war. There's going to be anarchy. There's going to be just terrible calamities that are going to take place. And so we're being removed from the Valley of Death. So in him, speaking of Jacob and thus the Israelites and the children of the covenant, there will be those who leave based upon the choices they have made. Gleaning, smaller, secondary harvests, as in going around, as encompassing and shaking them off as a means of harvesting an olive tree. Two or three ripe olives in the top uppermost branch. Four or five on her fruitful branches which have been separated. Prophetically declares Yahweh, the mighty one of Yisrael, of individuals who engage and endure with God. What do you think he's talking about here? Want to take a stab at it?
Well, yeah, he would be talking about the people that are trumpeting his words now. Period.
Yep. They're going to leave.
That's it.
Right? They're
that's
going
a,
to leave
a,
you the Valley of Death.
That's a small group. That is such a small group. I mean, we are a tiny, tiny, tiny group. Really.
Now, if we use Yahweh's repetitive metaphor of numbers representing thousands. It's like, you know, the 2 days represents 2,000 years. And so if we use that metaphor here, and it's a metaphor that's repeated many, many times, so it's a pretty sound metaphor here. And we tie this into Yahweh's second statement on the first of those two tablets, where he talks about thousands are going to receive his mercy by closely examining and carefully considering the terms and conditions of the covenant.
Well, there's your mercy right there. There it is.
So two or three, four or five. Now, olives represent saved souls, just as does the standing grain. The olives, because they're anointed with, they're immersed in, they represent the Spirit.
Because yeah, they're covered in the ruach.
Right,
basically.
Yeah, they're covered in the ruach. It's the olive produced oil that was healing. It produced oil that that could be used for the purest light in the ancient world, and it was used for anointing. So those olives represent those who are going to be harvested at this time. It is a gleaning, a small secondary harvest. And God is saying here that it's going to be two or three ripe olives in the top uppermost branch, and four or five on her fruitful branches which have been separated. So I suspect here, and you know, no, we're not given, we're not told explicitly, but you know, we've been given noodles to try to figure these things out. I think what God is talking about here, and it could be one of two ways of looking at it, and I want to tell you both ways that I think you can use. One is that he's speaking of the two or three ripe olives from the top uppermost branch. That either represents the naturally born Yehudim, who are members of the covenant, or it represents just Yehuda, as opposed to Yisrael. You know, Yisrael would be, that could be from any one of the 12 tribes that are naturally born, that are also participants in the covenant, or it could represent just Yehuda, one tribe. I think it represents all of the naturally born through Abraham, Yishak, and Jacob. And I think the four or five represents us Goyim who have been adopted into the covenant. And some of us are going to be surprised saying, oh, I didn't know we were actually Yisraelite, but what a nice surprise. So I think that's what we're talking about. I think we're talking about 7,000 people, 2 or 3,000 that will come from natural sons of naturally born into the house of Yisrael, and 4,000 to 5,000 that are going to be adopted into the covenant.
And you know, one of the things I came to understand very early in this process was that we've got to be like Noah. We've got to be like Lot. We've got to be one in a million, really. You know, it came to me, you know, pretty early on that these people were pointed out, or like Abraham, out of the entire, you know, area there in Babylon, which was probably the most populated on the planet at the time, I would guess.
Yeah, probably the largest city in the world at the time.
Yeah, I would think so. You know, he's fucking one family out of each of those. You know, and that's it. And that's where we stand today. And from that point on, I knew that I would always be in great opposition to the world.
Correct.
And I am.
Yeah. Yeah. 7,000 people out of a world of 7 billion. We're not going to find a lot of people who agree with us.
No.
Who agree with Yahweh, because he said the way is unpopular and it's narrow and few find it.
And look, you see more and more of that. See, you get emails. I get this live FB, and so does everybody in the chat room. And you will get people that, oh, hey, brother, they're calling you brother. Hey, and I'm thinking, oh, boy, here comes another
one.
You know, and the next thing you know, oh, it doesn't matter. It's Jesus. It's Yeshua. It's, you know, come on. That's not what's important. And I'm going... You know, and this is why you're not my brother. I mean, I'm telling them that.
Right.
You know, and because you're clueless. You're a boob. Right. You're a moron.
Yeah, and you know, that's the vast majority of people. And Gus is pretty clear here. He's not grading on a curve. You know, you can't be 80% right and expect God to resolve the fact that you only acted upon four of the five conditions of the covenant. I mean, he said, for example, on the fifth condition of the covenant, that we as parents circumcise our sons, and that you be circumcised to participate in the covenant, that if you're not circumcised both of the spirit and of the flesh, that you are excluded. He didn't say, I will, you know, think long and hard about it, and it's likely that I will rule in one way or another. He didn't say, you know, I might look the other way. I might be merciful in this regard and disregard you disregarding my instructions. He just said flat out on the fifth condition of the covenant, and now he's done laying out the conditions of participating in the covenant. He says, if you don't do this, you're excluded. Period. Emphatic. End of conversation. You know, it's like, can Ishmael be part of the covenant? No. Absolutely not. I won't even consider it. This is not going to... You can know a lot of stuff. And if you do not agree to the terms and conditions of the covenant, I'm sorry. You're going to
walk
left
out of Babylon first. I mean, boy, that's the hardest thing to get them to do.
That really is. That's the first of them.
Yeah. Well, walk out of there.
So then it goes on to say how different, you know, this, Damascus being destroyed gets a few sentences. Syria falling, the government out of Damascus and the Syrian government falling gets a sentence or two. Israel being thinned at the waist, the timing of that gets a sentence or two. This harvest is getting a lot of attention. So from God's perspective, right now, the thing that's the most important, even though there's only 7,000 souls being harvested, but this harvest is a big deal to God. He goes on and on about this harvest, telling us who's going to be taken, where they're going to come from, how many there's going to be, when it's going to occur, all of that. Now what he's telling us is, all right, for those of you who are harvested, the few, this is how different your experience is going to be from the world that you come from. He's reemphasizing the point that he made in the second of the three statements he etched on the first tablet. In that specific day, this individual, this descendant of Adam, will genuinely regard and consistently accept the Almighty, his Maker, and his eyes will actually and continuously look toward God, the set-apart one of Yisrael. So then, he shall never regard, except consider, nor look upon the religious altars, the works of what fingers have made. They will focus not upon the Asherah, the religious myths representing the Mother of God and the Queen of Heaven, who is the consort of Lord Baal. They're not going to consider Easter and Christmas and Christianity, which have grown out of Asherah, or the worship of sun god images and resulting religious monuments. That kind of stuff isn't going to exist in heaven. The difference between heaven and earth is defined therein. That in heaven, the focus is all upon Yahweh, exclusively. And in heaven, there is absolutely no trace of any competition. No religious competition, no religious imagery of any kind. That's the difference. So we're going to go from a world that very few people regard Yahweh, and most people love their religion, to a world where everyone that is there loves Yahweh, and no one has any interest in anything that is religious. Quite a change.
Yeah, because religion in this world gets so much undue respect. I mean, it's unbelievable to me. Really,
it is. Right. And you're considered a horrible person if you do not respect religion in today's world.
Yeah.
All right. So now that God has spoken of the harvest, he's going to return to those who have been left behind. In that specific day, it shall come to be that the cities of his, he's still addressing Jacob's and thus Israel's refuge, defensive fortifications shall be abandoned, like an occult presence in the thicket, as if drugged with mind-altering incantations or biological agents. The moment we're gone, Israel's defenses fail. They could fail because of biological agents. They could fail because of the onslaught of this occult presence that's going to flood into the country. They could fail for any number of reasons, but Israel's going to be a horrible place to be right then. And then the uppermost branch of the olive, relationally and beneficially, will be completely deserted for a period of time. So there's going to be a period of time where there's going to be no trace of God on this planet. Because of the presence of the children of Israel, and so appalling desolation and stupefying ruin, a stunning and astonishing deforestation, horrible devastation, leaving these places ravaged and temporarily uninhabitable, completely deserted and desolate, so that a wasteland will exist for a time as a result of the choices that have been made. This is, this is easily as bad as something could possibly be. So God's saying Israel's going to survive, but it's barely. It's going to get to be a horrible situation.
Well, you're talking for sure. We know over in Zechariah, 2/3 dead.
Right.
That's bad news.
That's bad,
right there.
Bad news. Yeah. Indeed, because branded by another, you, he's still speaking to the Israelites who have been left behind, who are being devastated at this moment. You have completely ignored and have actually forgotten, becoming totally ignorant of the God of your salvation and deliverance, your Savior, and the rock of your protection and refuge. You do not remember nor mention the Most High. So you began by saying, would you support the IDF? Yeah, up to a point. But God is saying that the IDF here is going to fail. So ultimately, if your trust isn't in Yahweh, you're going to be devastated. That's the bottom line here. So the IDF will fail. What is happening now in Israel, the IDF cannot stop. And yet God's going to allow it to get to the point where Israel finally realizes that they are incapable of defending themselves. That mighty military that they have built that has prevailed in 1948, that prevailed in 1967, that prevailed in 1974, it's going to fail this time. And they're going to witness it and become totally and completely isolated and petrified. And only then will God intervene. But it's going to get worse before it gets better. Now, God is saying that it's that rather branded by another, that you've completely ignored and are totally ignorant of the God of your salvation, well, he's going to talk about them. He says, therefore, you plant the Lord's vines. The Lord's vines, this is a very prevalent practice of serving Adonis, which means the Lord, and planting plants in association with the worship of Adonis, the Lord. And you continuously sow an illegitimate, unauthorized, and loathsome means to estrangement by way of a vine branch that needs to be pruned. So, Larry, those folks that talk about rabbinic Judaism and the insights they can glean from rabbinic Judaism, they're going to be pruned. You know, religion of Judaism is this unauthorized, illegitimate, and loathsome means to estrangement by way of the vine branch that needs to be pruned. He's not talking about any other place than the remnant that is left over in Yisrael, the religious in Yisrael, the political in Yisrael. And he says, man, you're going to be pruned. And it's not just a little pruning here. Two out of every three are going to die.
That's rough. It's a rough go. I mean, I brought this up to him. I brought it up to him.
Uh-huh.
So we can go right over here to Zechariah.
Yeah.
You don't have any way around this.
Right, 2/3.
And then I believe after the 2/3, then when the major attack comes, Megiddo, that half the city that's left then has to leave. So you're really going 50% after the two-thirds, you know.
It could be as little as one-seventh by the time we're done. Therefore, you plant the Lord's vines, and you continuously sow an illegitimate, unauthorized, loathsome means to estrangement by way of a vine branch that needs to be pruned. In that day, you raise your garden. And in the early part of the day, your seed, it's going to bud and sprout. But you're going to reap a shaken and corrupt heap, which will be piled up and thrust aside. In the daytime, there will be weakness, affliction, and tribulation, including the influence of incurable and incapacitating physical pain and mental anguish. Now, is God speaking of his covenant children at this point?
No.
No. He's speaking of those naturally born Israelites who have, up to this point, ignored him, rejected him, worked against him, been arrogant. He is thrusting aside with the religion of Judaism. This is not Christianity. This is not Islam that he's talking about here now. He's going to deal with Islam, and he's going to deal with Christianity. But right now, it's Judaism that he's talking about is going to be ravaged. And by the way, he's not doing the ravaging.
No, I know. And he said he never would. He said, "I'll let you know. Men are going to give you your stripe."
Right. He said, if you honor the terms and conditions of the covenant, if you respect them, if you act upon them, your world is just going to be in this temporal life is going to be the best that you can possibly imagine from every possible perspective, including you're going to be at peace with your neighbors. You're going to be the envy of the world. But if you reject these terms and conditions of the covenant, which he said that they have done, then, you know, your lot's going to be devastating. And
and that's another thing. You know, Yahweh's words are always good. I mean, his word's good, period. We know that. How is it I can talk to somebody involved in Judaism and explain that to them, and they want to disregard so much of his words, and they want to go, "We're his chosen people." Oh, well, whoop-de-whoop.
It's too bad that you didn't choose him. He chose you. You just didn't choose him back.
He's pretty clear.
Whoa.
I mean, World War II should have made that clear. The Holocaust should have made that clear.
There are two woes here. Now, God has now expressed his issue to Israel. He has already issued them. He didn't use the term woe to Israel, but it's about as woeful as you can get. But now he says woe, because with Israel, he's not giving them a warning. He's just telling them this is reality. It's a reality that you have made. You've made this bed. It's going to be anguishing. It's going to be painful. You made this bed. But now, as it relates to those who are going to inflict this pain, he does say woe to them. It's a warning. They ought not to. You know, God is going to wipe them out now. And so God is giving them a warning before he wipes them out. He says, woe, be wary of a great many nations, roaring like hordes of agitated terrorists, these multitudes of confused and loud-mouthed militants flaunting what they possess, similar to the chaotic uproar of loudly snarling and growling seas. They will wail in agitated and anguished screams, and the roar of societal chaos of the people of these nations will be like the horrible uproar of the floodwaters. Intensely and in great numbers, with grating passion, they will continually strive to desolate and lay waste and will be destroyed. Folks, I'm not going to speculate here. I'm telling you what's happened. This is Islam. Islam has come together as a great many nations. There's 57 Islamic nations, but they're not coming just from those 57 Islamic nations. Muslims are coming from every nation on earth. They're roaring. And if you look at the pictures of Muslims who are enraged, just look at their mouths are open. They're screaming. Their eyes are shooting out hatred. And they are terrorists. They're agitated. They're terrorists. There's multitudes of them. They're confused by the most satanic religion ever conceived. They are loud-mouthed. They think that they possess God on their side. They've been given great wealth through oil. They think that they have these powerful militaries, and they're going to deploy all of these weapons, similar to the uproar that you would see from a snarling and growling sea. Now, sea is a metaphor for not Yisrael. Yisrael is the land. The sea is not Yisrael. That's one of the references to sea, but there's more to the sea than this. Also, when you're dealing with the ocean and there's a tidal wave of coming at you, the tidal wave destroys virtually everything in its wake, does it not?
Well, yeah, it does.
Have you ever seen a nation that was able to stop a tidal wave?
Can't be done.
Can't be done. It can't be done. No. Japan had tidal wave fences, you know, and when they lost all of those cities and those nuclear power plants, did they work? No.
No, of course they won't work.
Have you ever seen what happens to a place like New Orleans when the floodwaters come? You ever seen a society that's able to stop floodwaters?
No, this can't be done.
No. So what God is saying here by using these metaphors is he's talking about a flood, a tidal wave of those opposed to Israel, of terrorists. And by using these terms, both because the tidal wave and the floods are destructive, and because they cannot be stopped, and because they represent that which is not Israel, he's telling us this is what's going to happen. Muslims are going to flood into Israel from the land, from the sea. It'll be a tidal wave. It'll be a great flood. They will be loud. They will be obnoxious. It will be confusing, and you will not be able to stop them, and they will be awesomely destructive. That is what's being conveyed here. This is not hard. This, you know, there's things that you really have to scratch your head and say, okay, I want to see if I can put this in context of what we're witnessing in the world. A 5-year-old that can read the newspaper can put this one together. And it's universal. This is the Magog War. This is a great many nations. This massive number of people who gather together will be like the horrible chaos and riotous roar of floodwaters. Massively great, widespread, and abundant shall be their desire to destroy everything while they strive to lay waste, giddy at the process as they crash into the land as a massive and raging storm. All right, so that's the Magog War. Virtually every nation on earth is going to send multitudes of people. Could be hundreds of millions of these jihadists, of these Islamic terrorists. And they have invaded the land of Israel to lay their sights on its pillage and destruction. But he's going to rebuke them. He's going to issue a warning against them while criticizing their corruption. And they will be forced to flee, taking flight as a result of being driven back, ultimately ceasing to exist on account of being alienated. God doesn't intervene very often, Larry. It's very infrequent when he intervenes. But when he does, he's deliberate. He's thorough. He does the job that needs to be done. He made a promise to Abraham. He made a promise to Yishak. He made a promise to Jacob that his relationship with the children of the covenant would be resolved. He's made a promise to reconcile and renew the covenant. He's going to do it. And he can't do it if Israel is destroyed. If Israel is destroyed, who in the world is he reconciling and renewing and reaffirming his covenant with on the day of Yom Kippurim and 6,000 Yah that he speaks of so vividly in Yirmiyah and in Zechariah? If he does not spare Israel from total annihilation, he's not able to honor any of those promises, is he?
That's correct, yeah.
So God's not going to intervene to spare America. He's not going to intervene to spare France or Russia or China.
Yeah, it's amazing people actually think these
right.
things.
But he is going to intervene to spare a remnant of Israel because he made a promise. And he's incapable of dishonoring.
And he does not say they're not going to live in misery during that time, because they are.
They are.
They are.
They are.
Yeah.
But you know, he is going to intervene. He says, but he's not, he's given them a warning, and now he's going to chastise them. He is not politically correct. He is not going to say, oh, you know, let's all just coexist. You know, you got a few things wrong, but can't we just all get along?
Yeah, compromise is something that we would expect out of political actors.
Right.
There's no compromise. I don't give an inch of compromise.
No.
Yeah, you don't like it? I don't care.
You know, when you mirror Yahweh's approach, as Dode figured out, when his words are your words and you mirror his approach, his perspective, you can't be wrong.
Right.
But when you go out and venture out on your own and try to apply your own reasoning, you can be wrong. But you can't be
wrong.
You
know, one of the reasons Adam was yeah, I agree with that. But, you know, one of the reasons Adam was put out of the garden was so he would learn to want Yahweh, really. He'd
correct.
Get the option. And the option is either dealing with the only straight game in town that there's ever been, from what
that's
I
right.
can tell.
Right.
Or go out there and bust your hump and get nothing out of it in the end.
Yeah.
And that's our options. And
right.
there's no in between. And so anybody that wants, you know, there's only a Zob or Bereath, right? And
correct.
So you're either going to be Bereath or a Zob, and most are going to be a Zob.
Correct.
And what I find is that by far the majority of people out here think that singing Kumbaya, holding hands, and compromising is okay.
And that's one of the biggest poisons out there. Does this sound to you like Yahweh is loving his enemies? Does it sound like Yahweh is loving his people's enemies? And
no,
he will rebuke them,
message.
Issuing a warning against them while criticizing their corruption. He's going to say, what in the world's the matter with you? Why in the world would anybody in their right mind, I created you with a mind, and here you're killing for a wannabe God that is so transparent, is Satan? Are you nuts? Why did you squander your life? Why did you believe this nonsense? Yeah, I'll tell you what.
It's hard for me to imagine, but I mean, that's you know, one of the biggest poisons out there is political correctness. It's the art of compromise. And I might compromise in a lot of business decisions or something like that. I'm not making one ounce of compromise when it comes to Yahweh's word. Not an ounce.
So he's going to rebuke them, which is the antithesis of compromise. He's going to criticize their corruption, and then they're going to be forced to flee. He's not giving them an option at this point. They're going to be forced to flee. They'll be driven back, ultimately ceasing to exist on account of having been alienated. And they will be chased, pursued, and driven away, similar to the chaff that dies and is discarded on the hills before the approaching presence of the Spirit. And like chariot wheels or troop transports rolling like tumbleweeds before the approaching presence of the storm. So it's the Spirit of Yahweh, the set-apart Spirit, that's going to blow them away. Literally blow them away. They're going to be blown away as chaff. You're going to, whew, and goodbye and good riddance, you are gone. They're troop transports like tumbleweeds. Now, there is a portion of this that I want everyone to recognize. He's now, there have been tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions, and I suspect hundreds of millions of Muslim terrorists that have flooded into Israel. And he's going to blow them away with his Spirit before the approaching presence of the storm. That tells you that this Magog war, oh yeah, it's bad. It's horrible. Lots of people are going to die. He is probably going to annihilate hundreds of millions of people with a single breath.
And then it gets worse from there.
And
wow.
Then it gets worse because we've got the approaching presence of the storm. Approaching the point in time of the darkness of the Arab sunset, then behold terrorism, the deliberate and dreadful mauling and murdering of civilians to promote a political and religious objective. In the time before the dawn, it is over and for naught. This is the fate of those who were deceived regarding their merits. The result of flattering propaganda, the reward for those coveting booty who engage in a military conquest to plunder and pillage us, and the lot, the recompense, the retribution coming to those who seek to conquer us, carrying off the spoils of war.
Oh, wow.
God is citing the Quran to say, yeah, I know what the Quran says. Yep. And I know you're Muslims and you believe the Quran. Well, guess what?
Well, there's nobody else that would do that. You know, most Christians wouldn't attack Israel.
No. Yeah, God is saying, you know, I know the Quran says that stealing booty is lawful and good. I got news for you. It isn't.
Mm-hmm. And by the way,
news for you thought that you were going to conquer Israel and rape the women and steal their possessions, and that was going to be your great triumph on behalf of God. I got news for you. It's not.
Well, there's nothing else to take in Israel. He's literally talking about Muslims, yeah.
It's the darkness of the Arab. Isn't this an amazing term, though? It's the darkness of the Arab sunset. Terrorism, the deliberate and dreadful mauling and murdering of civilians. But then God says, I'm telling you here, before the dawn, it's over. It's for naught. That's the fate of those who have been deceived.
Hamas means terrorism, doesn't it?
Yeah.
In Paleo-Hebrew.
Yeah. So there we go. Now we know we're brought up to date. We know what's going to happen on the Magog War before the approaching storm. Yah was going to blow them away, and then he's given them a warning. It's hundreds of millions of Muslims, and they're gone. And God is saying, this is the consequence for that kind of religion, for that kind of religious behavior. For that kind of militarism, this is the consequence. You got what you deserved. Now shut up. You're dead. You're gone. All right. That brings us to another woe. And it's another woe in concert with the approaching storm and all these references to the sea and bringing a terrible force to bear against Israel from the sea. This is the first statement of 18:1. Now, there is no distinction in the Hebrew text between 17 and 18. This is just the next sentence. Woe, alas, expressing dissatisfaction and a warning. To the land of whirling and buzzing wings, which is from the region beyond the direction of the rivers of Cush. Wait, we've been through this before, but there is one nation that's known for its whirling and buzzing wings. Only one. And that nation has all manner of attack helicopters that it's used since Vietnam to ravage people. I think most of us have been blazoned into our memory the visual image of Robert Duvall saying that he loves the smell of napalm in the morning, where to the March of the Valkyries, you've got these Huey helicopters, guns blazing, rockets firing, are destroying a village in Vietnam. And most of us know the shock and awe of the Apache helicopters as we killed and maimed so many people in Iraq and Afghanistan. That is what we're known for. God says, "Whoa!" Now, what is this
our giant
region?
Navy?
Yeah. Well, he's going to get to that. He says this is a region beyond, a place situated across and the opposite side of the direction of the rivers of Cush. There are two things you can look at here. One is that if you look at the rivers of Cush from the perspective of Jerusalem, as they're described in Bar-Reshith, which is one of the rivers flowing out of Eden, waters the area of Cush. And it's described as the area of northern, this is where the rivers flow into, not where they begin, but northern Iraq and Iran today. And if you draw a line from Jerusalem through northern Iraq and Iran, where the rivers of Cush and the mountains of Cush, there's even the Cush Mountains today, and you draw that line on a globe, It passes through the northernmost part of Alaska. There's another reference to the rivers of Kush, and it's the Nile Delta. And there are lots of statements that equate the rivers of Kush with the Nile Delta, where the Nile divides into many tributaries. If you draw a line from Jerusalem through the Nile Delta, it passes through the Florida Keys and then Hawaiian Islands. So from both perspectives, you have the further northern part of the United States and the further south. Now, he's also said so many times that this wave is going to come from the seas. If you draw a line from Jerusalem through the through Gibraltar, the Straits of Gibraltar, that line intersects the United States and Washington, D.C. That's what he's talking about here, folks. It's America. It's a bullseye. It's the top. It's the bottom. It is America. All right. This goes to, it dispatches envoys by way of the sea. And so in floating vessels on the surface of the waters, the messengers travel indulgently and immorally as well as swiftly. The United States has the largest navy in the history of the world. It's the fastest navy in the history of the world. We are the most indulgent and immoral, arrogant people in the history of the world. We're the first nation that's been able to project its force halfway around the world by way of a navy. We influence the world by way of our navy. In fact, even just this last week, the Secretary of Defense said that he was going to diminish the size of the Army substantially so that he could spend that money in building a naval fleet that was capable of more swiftly and deadly force across the oceans. He was even going to sacrifice the coastal vessels that protect America's coast and going to increase the number and size and capability of those vessels that can more swiftly project a deadly force across the oceans. We have more battleships than the rest, there are more aircraft carriers than the rest of the world combined, and we're building two more as we speak.
Yeah, and by the way, one of the things aircraft carriers really do, they'll come out and they'll set off the coast, you know, of whatever
right.
country,
right.
And they'll have dignitaries come on board.
Of course.
That's what they'll do.
Yeah, to meet with our envoys. It's how we influence the world. It's how we project a force.
Yep.
This nation of people from different races and places, they're tall, they're intoxicated, they're immodest, and they have a propensity to take things away from others. They're scrubbed clean, smooth-skinned, and completely shaven, typically reckless. These people are feared from here to there and beyond in a future time. This population, which is comprised of many different races, routinely vomits up and spews out nonsense in a strange foreign language, talking down to others, mocking them, while continually marching off to war based upon this condescending and moronic rhetoric, always trying to impose its influence, establishing the rules, while eagerly expecting to throw inhabitants out of their land. It aggressively subdues others, trampling them down, kicking them out. A land whose country is divided by rivers. Well, there's about, I think I once said a dozen references to America in those words. Well, that's an understatement. And I don't want to go into today because I'm going to devote a series of Shattering Myth shows to this prophecy, to all of the ways that we can ascribe these traits to America. But I want to read through it one more time, then we'll move on to the next verse. This nation of people from different races and places, they're tall, they're intoxicated, they're immodest. They have a propensity to take things from others. Consider the native population of this country. They are scrubbed clean, smooth-skinned, and completely shaven, and yet typically reckless. Consider that compared to the nature of the Islamic terrorists who are not scrubbed clean nor smooth-skinned, Israel's most common foe. These people are feared, sometimes even revered, from here to there and beyond in a future time. This nation, which is comprised of many different races, routinely vomits up and spews out nonsense in a strange foreign language, talking down to others, mocking them, while continually marching off to war, 101 wars in the since America was first invaded by the Europeans, on this condescending and moronic rhetoric. Boy, I tell you what, you listen to the news today and you want to scream. And I've come the closest I've ever come in my life to want to throwing something into the television as I hear this lame presentation of the world according to Washington and why they need to be lecturing everyone else, eagerly expecting to throw inhabitants out of their land. It aggressively subdues. It's a nation whose country is divided by rivers. All right, we move.
There's only one country that can be. I mean, let's get real. Even Russia, big bad guys they are. They beat up on their little bitty neighbors. You know, that's what they do. Yeah. They don't run around the world telling everybody what to think. They don't do it.
No.
They really don't.
And they're not the ones that trying to divide Israel into two. They're not the ones who are supplying the weapons that will be wielded against Israel. That's the United States. They don't project a force. By way of the sea, they're a very small navy. All of those who inhabit the earth, and also those who dwell in the land, when the sign on the upright pole is lifted up on the mountain, you will continually and actually see. And also when the shofar sounds, you will literally hear. So now after describing America, God's saying, I'm telling you here, then I'm going to act again. Now, when God acts, he only acts to protect Yisrael. He does not act on behalf of anyone else. So now that he's described America, God said, I'm putting my sign up on Mount Zion, where, you know, the signpost on the way. I'm going to set up my banner on the upright pole, right there in the midst of the land, right there on the mountain. And I'm going to do it in a way that no one can mistake that it's me doing it. I'm going to sound the shofar. Everyone in the world is going to hear it. He's saying that he's going to act again, that he's going to say, I'm establishing my upright pole and the sign on the upright pole right there that's going to be lifted up on the mountain. It'll be Mount Zion. And everyone on the earth is going to see it. Everyone on the earth is going to hear the shofar sound. It's a battle cry against and him digging in against America. We're going to do something really stupid against his chosen people and against his promised land.
Well, we're not we, are we?
No, but the United States is going to do something really stupid. We're not going to be here. But our country is going to do, the United States, where we live, is going to do something. Well, not everybody, by the way. There's a lot of people listening to this program who live in Great Britain, who live in New Zealand, who live in the Republic of South Africa, who live in Australia, who live in South America, who live in Canada. So when I say we, I shouldn't be saying that, but the United States is going to act very badly. Indeed, because here and now, at this point in time, says Yahweh, as for me, I will be silent and at peace, removed from the tribulation in a better place. So, after God has established his sign on the mountain that means signpost along the way, after he sound his trumpet, after he's dealt with this country, the United States, he's going to let the rest of the world just battle it out. He's going to protect Israel. In other words, he's going to say, you know, Israel is not yours for the taking. But the rest of the world, you know, you guys want to go off and kill everybody? Go ahead and do what you're going to do because I am returning to heaven. I'm going to let you guys have at it. He says, then I will look, choosing to always be observant in my dwelling place, like a radiant and glowing, warm and passionate light, like a covering cloud, misting and encompassing dew, in the warmth and enthusiasm of a harvest. He's going to enjoy the harvest. He's talking about his nature. He's warm. He's approachable. He's all-encompassing. And he's going to spend time in his home with his children while he watches the rest of the world destroy itself. That's Yeshayah 18:4. Now, indeed before the approaching presence of the harvest, as the budding blossoms form and become completely perfect, as when the unripe and unfit fruits are dealt with for becoming a cluster of sprigs, then they will be stopped. They will be taken down and cut off, banished and excluded. The contemptuous, worthless trindles of this vine with the pruning knife. So then, with regard to the forsaken and spreading branches, they will be completely rejected and totally removed, cut off and separated. All right, so God's going to return to heaven. And while he's in heaven, he's going to anticipate the approaching harvest. The approaching harvest is Yom Kippurim. That's what he's looking forward to. He's going to enjoy the harvest that he's already had. He's going to look forward to Kippurim. But before those who are budding blossoms that formed and become perfect so that they can be included in the Teruah harvest, those who, they finally said, whoa, wait a minute. God has established his sign right here on Mount Zion. He's blown his shofar. He's wiped the Muslims away. He's stopped the approaching Americans. This God, man, he's reliable. He's dependable, and he is powerful. Let's get our act so that our act is in compliance with his covenant, so that we're saved from this onslaught. And he says those budding blossoms are going to become perfect, but there's a lot of unripe and unfit fruit that has to be dealt with still, and those sprigs are going to be cut away and banished. They're going to be excluded. They're going to be considered worthless. They're going to be the victim of the pruning knife. So with regard to the forsaken and spreading branches, they're going to be completely rejected and totally removed. God is not going to grade on the curve. There's no gray area here. You're either with him or you're against him. If you're against him, goodbye. It's over. You've been cut off, separated, estranged, azab. Now, what comes next, I think, explains what separation from Yahweh is all about. I think this is a word view of hell. Now, am I sure of that? No. But I suspect that what God says next is a word view of what it's going to be like to be in Sheol. They shall actually be continuously abandoned and forever forsaken, altogether, completely, and all at once, for the mountain birds of prey and for the beasts of the realm. And they will abruptly awaken in the summer and take vexing and exasperating action against them. That is the birds of prey and the beasts. All of the birds of prey, flying creatures which hunt and kill things and then prey upon the dead, and also the beasts of the realm.
Hello?
They will be among, upon, and against them during the autumn and the winter, continuously ridiculing and taunting them for actually being irrational and for being consistently confused. So I think what God is saying is you want a taste of what Sheol is going to be like? This is a taste of what Sheol is going to be like.
So do you think that literally means the beasts and the birds? I think it does.
Yeah, yeah, I do. I think that the birds here are not birds in the sense of feathered creatures. The feathered creatures aren't going to be praying. The birds don't ridicule. Birds don't taunt.
No, they don't. No, that's true.
Okay.
Yeah.
And nor do wild animals. The beasts and the birds of prey here?
These are people.
Are demons.
Yeah.
No, they're demons.
Demons, wow.
Demons. Demons. And those who are in league with demons. He's describing Sheol. He's just saying that these Yehudim are Yisraelites that have been cut off. When they're separated and they go to the place of separation of Sheol, this is what they're going to find. They're going to be mocked. Demons and these beasts, Satan's demons are very often equated to beasts. They're going to prey on them. They're going to mock them. They're going to say, boy, were you ever stupid. You believe that stuff? Why could you believe that stuff? It's obviously untrue. I mean, you were given a brain, and forever they're going to be ridiculed. They're going to be tormented. They're going to be taunted for being stupid. That's what's going to happen.
Wow.
He's describing the conditions that are going to exist in Sheol.
And that's
time.
What the art of compromise will get you. There you go.
Yep. Now, yes, that's what misleading others will get you. Now, what's really interesting is now what happens next. And what happens next is profound. At this time, she, speaking of the set-apart spirit, shall direct and guide him. This is the remnant of Jacob who has been spared. Delivering him. This is the blossoms that have been prepared and perfected. At this time, she shall direct and guide him. Delivering him. She's going to instruct him. Showing him the way. Leading him. Carrying him. Bringing him. As a gift which is agreeable. One born out of respect and reverence. To approach Yahweh of the vast array of spiritual implements. People who have become family, who were arrogant but are now altered and willing to follow, and who were perverse but now have been scrubbed clean, will come out of a nation feared from here to there and beyond in this future time.
Yeah, they're coming out of the U.S.
Yep,
yeah.
Which is comprised of many different races and places, with strange and foreign language, talking down to others while continually marching off to war because of their condescending rhetoric. Always trying to impose its influence, establishing the rules, eagerly throwing inhabitants out of their land, aggressively subduing others whose country is divided by rivers, brought to the place of the name of Yahweh, of the vast array of spiritual messengers, being brought to Mount Zion. You know, an equal number of Yehudim live in Yisrael as live in America. Between 40 and 42% of the worldwide population of Israelites live in Israel. The same number live in America. God is going to let his spirit, going to have his spirit, remove those Israelites, his children, from America at this time, and he's going to bring them to Mount Zion to be with him. That is how this story ends. And it ends because what happens in Yisrael once God has prevailed and delivered on his promises for his children? Does not he reconcile his relationship with Yisrael and with Yehudim?
Yeah, it sure does. Yeah.
And reaffirm his covenant with them? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he's done. He's brought them all back together so that he can reconcile this relationship, restore the covenant. And they are all together. So the Yehudim who have survived all of this are now home. Perhaps the most powerful prophecy, most pertinent prophecy of our day. So my friends, my hope is to share all of this on Shattering Myths in future months. But between now and then, I wanted to share it with you because it speaks so loudly, so clearly of our world. And as we return to Shattering Myths a week from today, not Shattering Myths, but Yadi Yah Radio and the Shabbat program, we're going to return to Psalm 119. But I thought this was a worthy detour.
It was interesting. It was very, very interesting to hear. I always thought that there was a harvest and then a secondary harvest there, but then you kind of cleared me up. So the first primary harvest he was talking about was Bikurim, and then I guess the secondary harvest is Teruah, and it's just that small
right.
to begin with.
Right, and then there's a final harvest which takes place when Yahweh brings all of his children home.
Mm-hmm.
And he celebrates Yom Kippurim. And that's his story. It's consistent. He's sticking with it. He's told us how the events are going to play out from the perspective of Yahweh and the perspective of Yisrael. And so it isn't good to be the recipient of either of these two woes, because to be woed in the midst of all this means that you're a foe of Yisrael, a foe of Yisraelites, a foe of Yahweh. And one of those two foes is Muslims. The other foe is the United States.
And it's amazing to me. It's I got to tell you, it's amazing to me. I could show people right where Yahweh's landing. I mean, you know, he's pretty direct about where he's even going to land, exactly what's going to happen.
Right.
A little bit. And, you know, he's speaking spiritually. No, he's literally.
No. He's
people don't believe. What it comes down to is people don't believe what Yahweh says.
Yeah.
That's what it all comes down to. They've gotten so used to somebody interpreting like it's a giant comic book in a dream, you know, kind of thing, that they just have these wild interpretations that don't even come close when all they got to do is read it. And
whether it's Christians who are completely misguided from top to bottom, where everything they say is either untrue or a half truth. Or it's Jews, where everything they say is either untrue or a half-truth. Or Muslims, where everything they say is untrue. You know, it doesn't take a lot to prioritize what God had to say, to observe what he had to say, to listen to what he had to say, and to see how what he has to say is so different than these religious interpretations. And therefore, to abandon the religion which God proves is false, and then accept him.
Well, I mean, he's real clear about taking part in any religion. If anybody goes to the Sukkah section of Yada Yada and really starts looking at all the things he tells you not to participate in,
right.
It's every bit of religion and man's political correctness that you could possibly imagine.
Right.
And that means that there's not going to be an ounce of it drug into his home. And those of us that stand firmly against all that trash, we're his people. And there's not many of us.
And he's
going to
remove us from the valley of death before all this transpires.
And that's a good way to put
it.
There is a
1% part of me and you who have endured enough that say, you know, damn the torpedoes. Let us stay and let's try to warn more people. I know it's going to be hellish, but, you know, let us try to...
You're on your own there, pal. I don't want to be around during that time.
But, you know, God's going to take care of that. He's going to have two people that are going to be effective witnesses for him. He's going to make sure that they can speak the languages of everyone. Everyone's going to hear them in their own language. They're going to be broadcast around the world. Everyone's going to know Yah's position. Yah's going to have one of his messengers hold up the ten statements that have been etched in stone. Yah is going to establish his banner right there on Mount Zion. He's going to blow his shofar. He's going to blow away the opponents of Israel. He's going to expose and condemn them vocally. He's going to make it pretty clear that who he is. And you know, while I would like to make a contribution, he doesn't need me to do this. He's going to do this on his own. This is a time where God is going to say,
Eliyahu and Hena, isn't it?
Yeah,
he specifically says Eliyahu's got more work to do. And the only other good guess would be Henick because of the way he was taken. So I just can't.
I'm assuming it's those two. I mean, that's the most logical. Well, you know, one is specifically described. The other is not, and there could be any number of people. But Anak is the most likely because of the way.
Is that the way you pronounce? I always pronounce Henick. It's Anak.
I'm not positive, but. You know, it's Anak, Henick, the first person that was taken. You know, he was, and then he was not, and he was with Yah. I think that the fellow that we call Enoch, the name is Enoch, transliterated that way. I think it's likely that he's one of the two. But I won't go as far as to say that's for certain. It's
does
it really
matter?
And by the way, does it?
I love
Eliyahu.
Yeah,
Eliyahu is definitely one of the two. And does it really matter?
No, it doesn't matter.
No.
I just think it's those two, and I know Eliyahu is one of them. And he was always my personal favorite because he got out there and taunted the jerks, and that's what needs to happen to him.
I mean, all of them. Yeah, Eliyahu is perfect for you. Dodd is perfect for me. I'm probably more flawed than you are, and yet, you know, Dodd's whole thing is Well, let's use reason to understand this and to share what we have learned using words, singing, Yah's message to all who will listen. I really identify with Dode from top to bottom, and so he's my guy, and I can see how, and that's why there's a lot of people that engage with Yahweh, because, you know, Elia is a perfect mentor for Larry.
Well, I promise
really?
You he is. And,
yeah.
And I'm no less flawed than anybody. I'm
yeah,
nothing.
I know. But you know, Elia is a great example. But by the way, there's a few people who have been set up as examples to emulate. No, that's not the flaws of Dode, but certainly the understanding of Dode, the passion of Dode, the clarity of communication of Dode, the teaching of Dode is something to be emulated. And style and format of Elia is something, because God made it really clear, both of those dudes, they're part of the family.
No, they're tough, both of them.
Both tough.
My guess is Dode would be taking people's heads off with lawnmowers these days, really. I mean,
yeah.
And they have it coming. I'm at a point, I mean, even my own family, okay?
Yeah.
They don't want to listen. I mean, my own kids.
Yeah.
They don't care.
Yeah, I'm of the same boat. My youngest son does not understand how I can be so callous. Because my youngest son knows Yahweh, and he knows that his brother doesn't. And so, you know, he's wondering how in the world I can have a relationship with my eldest son when he has he knows the truth and hasn't embraced it. And how, why that doesn't eat me up alive, because it really bothers him. And it doesn't bother me. I know it should, but it doesn't. It's you know,
I don't know that it can bother you, because you'd run around bothered all the time.
Oh, that's right.
But every
so
time
I realize
share
that
the truth
he is an adult.
Kids.
I've shared the truth with him. He knows the truth. He can respond if he wants to respond. If he does, wonderful. And I'll kumbaya if he does. If he doesn't, that's his choice. I can't make it for him. It's the way Yah wants it to be. So I hope that he does. You know, I hope that I've shared enough that when some of these things that Yah's predicted come true, that he's one of those that say, whoa, 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 wow, yeah, I want to be in the right place at the right time with the right understanding. But, you know, it's not a lot of people, and I'm going to celebrate the brothers and sisters that we have and enjoy our family.
By the way, I want to say this before I get off the line here tonight.
Yeah.
I know we're off the air, but let me tell you, we got a pretty damn tough army there on FB these days.
That's great. That's
there's
great,
some sword-wielding people, and they're not to be messed with.
You know, and the sword is the word. And the sword cuts, it divides. It's and it should not bring peace. But when you're talking about army and you're talking about swords, you're not talking about, there's no one in Facebook that has ever threatened violence upon anybody or has ever brought harm to anybody
I'm not talking.
But
I'm
you're talking,
talking
about people
about
that won't take any
God's
garbage
words.
From religious people and wield Yahweh's word effectively at the religious, correct?
That's right. That's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah. And,
yeah, they're tough.
In that regard, that's the way Yahusha was. Yahusha was tough, uncompromising, sword-wielding. By sword-wielding, we're not talking about a military implement. We're talking about the word. And he wielded it with exactitude and with passion and an uncompromising fashion, because he knows what we talk about all the time, which is being tolerant of and accepting of religion and politics and militarism. That isn't loving. That isn't caring. That's not compassionate. It's the opposite of those things.
Well, compromise brings death. I mean, that's what it brings.
Correct.
And it doesn't just bring death spiritually. It brings death.
It brings death. Yeah, literally. Yep. All the religion compromises all the way through. And religion, if religion was just pure and it didn't compromise, then it wouldn't fool so many people. It's really deadly because, Paul, not everything that Paul said was a lie. He wove some threads of truth through his testimony, which made
While he was hoping everybody under the Torah would get castrated, he sided with them from time to time.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, just to give himself some credibility.
You know, and I've asked people. I got to thank you. I pulled the one deal out of there where he's talking about, he should have. He was wondering if he committed a sin by not charging, and how he had to rob another religious organization to help pay himself for this time he'd spent with this group. And
right.
I put that side by side with, everything's free. No
right.
money or cost to you.
Right. Yeah.
Made a little note out of it.
Participation in the covenant's not free. You've got to engage. There's a price to pay.
Any relationship takes some effort,
right.
doesn't it?
Right.
I mean,
right. There's no money involved.
That's what we're really talking about here.
Well, we have all, you and I, have spent money on behalf of the covenant, but we didn't spend the money to buy our place in the covenant. But the covenant participation is not free. You've got to be willing to engage and act. But salvation is free. We are invited to those invitations. And all the benefits of the covenant that come by way of those seven invitations, we don't contribute to diddly squat.
Well, I'm with you on that. I understand there's no cost to me. I get it.
Yeah, we're invited to a party, and all the benefits, all the party favors are supplied by Yahweh. But that's
true.
Relative to the side of the equation that's his responsibility. The side of the equation that's our responsibility is those terms and conditions, and some of them are costly. Walking away from religion and politics and economic schemes and patriotism
it's
and militarism
game.
And societal customs.
Yeah, it's a net gain.
You know, Larry, for all of us, it cost us initially, and then as we were completely separated and now have this perspective looking back on it and have come to know Yahweh and have gone on this voyage of discovery with him, even the most costly step along the way was a huge net benefit to us.
Sure it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm told routinely by Jackie, who does a lot of editing of Yada Yah, that when I speak of the conditions of the covenant that we must act upon, she says, every one of those conditions is a benefit for us.
Yeah, sure it is.
Yeah.
And Jackie's right. I mean,
she is right.
Yeah, I know she
yeah,
is.
Right. Yeah.
It's just that it's the ongoing battle. I mean, we just got to keep each other propped up a little bit here. That's about it.
Yep. Encouragement in the family is a good thing because we got a lot of foes. Yep.
Yeah.
And the foes are becoming more reckless, more uncompromising. And, the other day in Shattering Mist, I talked about the Arizona law where you can only behave in the way that the government says you can behave. And the only religion that you can practice is socialist secular humanism. And that... The judges have become the priests of the national religion of America, and the media is the evangelist.
What did he call Legosia? Legislate.
Right. Vomit. Vomit. I've got to go. My power just went out, so I'm in the dark.
All right,
again.
Pal. Hey, well,
right,
so
I got the program done, and the power went out again.
These were some really nice insights. I appreciated the show, really.
What I'm excited about here is that my mind is really operating right now on, let's say that my mind on a normal day is runs with eight cylinders, and it's okay. Today I was operating on two. I mean, I'm really thick-headed today, really slow. And the nice thing is that Yahweh empowers our insights. He enriches us with his teaching. And so long as we're studying his word and talking about it, our ability is really meaningless.
Oh, well, I could do it for, you know, around a campfire all night with the right group. And,
yeah,
you know, unfortunately, most of us aren't around the right group most of the time. And that's the problem we have, you know.
Correct.
And, you know, one day we will. It's just a pretty, yeah, it's pretty kind of a lonely path. I mean, when it gets right down to it. You know?
Yeah.
But,
all right, my friend. Well, I've got to get back up to the house, find some flashlights and some candles because I am in the dark.
Well, you go get them. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Have fun today.
Thanks.
I enjoyed doing this with you, Larry. Bye.